From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee philanthropist, businesswoman, and educator Betty Quadracci has died. We look back at her life and legacy. Then a Milwaukee doctor is trying to raise awareness about a new test for sepsis, which could save lives.
If we look at patient outcome data, up to 45% of patients that have sepsis may be treated inappropriately with that first choice of antibiotics.
A new book tells the story of Milwaukeean Danny Goodman. He was working in minor league baseball in the 30s when he had a novel idea, selling souvenirs.
All of these things that he came up with, many of them were met with resistance, but some of them were not, including, why don't we sell T-shirts with the team name on it?
And essayist Mel Miskimmon looks for a sign. Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Milwaukee Magazine president and publishing icon Betty Quadracci died this week. Quadracci co-founded the printing company Quad Graphics with her late husband Harry in 1971. The company purchased Milwaukee Magazine in the 1980s, and Quadracci served as its publisher until earlier this year. But while Quadracci was well known for her role in the publishing industry, she's also being remembered for her work as a philanthropist and as an educator. She founded the Waukesha Montessori School in 1965, and she helped create Waukesha's Head Start program there 3 years later. Kurt Chandler and Ann Christensen both worked for years with Betty Quadracci in their roles in Milwaukee Magazine, and they join me in the studio now. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Let's start with how Betty Quadracci shaped Milwaukee Magazine. She took it over and became publisher in the early 80s, right?
Quad Graphics bought the magazine. Harry and Betty bought the magazine in 1983. And Betty did not become publisher immediately. It was, I think, a few months, maybe a year before she assumed that role or was appointed that role, selected. And she had a little bit of a tough time at the start because people didn't take her seriously. They thought maybe this was just a job she could fill to kill some spare time.
They thought she was a dilettante in this sort of thing?
Yes, and she was not, as she proved over and over and over again. She really developed a vision, I think, for the magazine to do some edgy, hard-hitting reporting, and she wanted the best writers and photographers in not only the city but the state to contribute to the magazine. I mean, she wanted to make a difference in town. She wanted to be involved in the issues of the day. She wanted to promote the arts. She wanted to understand and profile people who were driving the city. And so it wasn't just another city magazine. It became a force that other local media were forced to reckon with. And if you compare it to other city magazines around the country, Milwaukee Magazine has had a national reputation for taking on those hard issues and being a little sassy at times, a little edgy and out front. And that was Betty's vision. It really was.
So it really wasn't like that before she took over?
I would say not. I mean, this was before my time, before Kurt's time. But the previous owners, it was a much different publication from what I've seen, because I've long gone through the archives of issues going back to the late 70s. At one point, the old WFMR owned the magazine. There was a very different voice there. And I would say for certain, you know, there wasn't that same kind of sense of the hard-edged and really, you know, getting at controversial issues.
Oh, yeah. Betty wanted the magazine to probe, and she wanted the magazine to take on sacred cows in Milwaukee. And it has over the years, and it will continue to. And that was not following anyone else's vision. That was Betty largely and, of course, Harry making that commitment. They had, I think, deep, deep feelings and convictions for the civic issues of Milwaukee. And as you see, as people see in their philanthropy, you know, they really were devoted to this city. And that, I think, came through in the magazine that they published.
You mentioned the word vision a couple of times, and I think that is a word that people seem to be associating with her across the board, whether it was with the magazine, whether it was with her philanthropic donations, whatever she attacked, it was with a vision in mind and with a real passion.
Well, you know, amongst ourselves, we've talked about how, and things I've observed many times over the years was just how much fire there was in her and her curiosity just about everything. And she worked harder probably than anybody I have ever seen, really. And you know, I've worked with a lot of editors. I've worked with a lot of writers who, and knowing the kind of being a workaholic and being a perfectionist and being that sort of having that sort of personality. I mean, she worked. I mean, she was tireless in the way she would attack things and approach things and the way she would run her business. She was, you know, extremely canny and very and just like people have said, the courage that she had. I think she just wouldn't really let go. And that came across when you would meet her in person, too. She's very, very warm. But also, I mean, she right away, you know, she wanted to know who you were and she focused in on you immediately and asked you a million questions.
It wasn't just lip service either. I mean, she had a genuine curiosity, really a reporter's curiosity, although she wasn't a journalist or didn't go to journalism school. Her mother did, interestingly. But Betty wanted to know about you. She wanted to know about the world. And she wanted to involve herself, engage herself in things around the city and the world. And she was challenging. She was direct. But she was also very charming. And she could win you over to her ideas and her commitment and devotion to issues and to really quality work.
Do you think it was the combination of that warmth and that sort of hard-headed, really laser focus that she had that made her so effective?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she was a hands-on person. Whether she was sitting on the board of directors of the Art Museum or becoming involved with the arts community, the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, or education. She was a Montessori teacher early in her career. I mean, she wasn't standing on the sidelines ever. She wanted to be involved. She wanted to get her hands dirty.
And she was a publisher, too, who, you know, although she wasn't doing like line-by-line editing, anything like that, I mean, she knew what we were working on and what our covers were going to be and had her own ideas about things and her own input, you know. But she also, you know, I never felt like she pushed, you know, any type of
idea. She didn't have an agenda or anything.
No, she did nothing like that. You know, and I mean, I cover restaurants and I felt like she always wanted to know what the hot new restaurants were. She always wanted to know that. But
she was playful too.
She was incredibly playful and she always, you know, she always wanted to know where she could get a good burger, which seems really odd when you think about it. But no, this woman loved a good hamburger. She's very, you know, just a very simple type of thing like that, that is kind of universal. Everybody loves a burger, right? But she, you know, she'd get me in these conversations and I would sometimes just laugh. And she would just get this really cute little playful look in her face. And this was just talking about restaurants, you know. But she always, you know, she always wanted to know what you were working on and what are you doing and are you getting all the help you need? Are you working hard enough? I mean, she took a great interest in everybody on staff. You know?
So it sounds like a good boss.
A good boss, a tough boss, again, a challenging boss, but she was inspiring. She really was because she engaged people. She did. She wanted to know genuinely what you were doing, what you were about, who did you talk to, and what else can you ask for in a publisher?
And she backed you up when things proved to be difficult?
She was embarrassed, I'm sure, among her circle of friends for really hard-hitting stories that the magazine did. She probably, you know, caught a lot of crap at social gatherings, but she never backed down and she always defended the magazine.
Always, always supportive. I mean, it didn't matter, you know, what it was. I mean, she stood by us.
Yeah, she did.
You know.
She had our back and that was important. I mean, that's what made the magazine as tough and in some cases strong and courageous as Betty was.
So how do you go forward then?
Well, her vision has shaped the magazine and has influenced various institutions in town, and the ship is still sailing. We're going to continue on that vision, on that mission, you know, with Betty as our inspiration, because that's where she took us and that's where we'll continue to move. I have no doubt that the magazine will continue on doing the quality work that she guided us towards, even though she's gone.
I feel like, you know, I think the worst thing would be if a magazine like ours, like her magazine, would not move forward. That's what she would want, expect and want us to do. That would be a legacy, one of her legacies. And I can't see any other way.
Yeah, I agree. I'm sure we'll be questioning ourselves on a direction of an article or a cover or an art design. And we might even in the back of our heads be thinking,
what would Betty say?
What would Betty think about this? Absolutely.
What do you think Milwaukee has lost with her passing?
Well, they've lost an innovator, a visionary, and somebody who truly stood up for her convictions, for what she believed in. If you just look to the east and see that beautiful building along the lakefront, not only did she and Harry write a check to make that a reality, but they were involved, particularly Betty, in getting that building up. I'm talking about the art museum, of course, the Calatrava edition. And those kind of new leaders, I would call them, are very important to the city. And I don't think there are as many leaders such as Betty Quadracci in this town. And to lose one of them is a big loss.
I'm also going to speak just from gender, too, and say for women, you know, like myself, to see someone, a woman like this in power, a woman of this kind of power, was really inspiring. So, you know, I think of that part, too.
So we've lost that as well.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in and talking a little bit about Betty and about her legacy. It is a big one and big shoes to fill.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Kurt Chandler is chief editor of Milwaukee Magazine. Ann Christensen is senior editor and dining critic. Milwaukee Magazine president and former publisher Betty Quadracci died Monday night. She was 75. A special edition of the magazine honoring her will be published in February. Coming up next, we'll learn about an old medical enemy, sepsis, and some new ways we have of diagnosing it and treating it. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect on WUWM right after this. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. A Milwaukee researcher is trying to raise the profile of a condition that can be fatal, but often flies under the radar of doctors and patients until it's too late. Around 500,000 people are hospitalized every year and treated for septicemia. The condition, better known as sepsis, is caused by a bacterial infection in the blood, and it can be lethal, especially in patients with additional underlying medical conditions. Dr. Nate Lederboer is the medical director for microbiology and molecular diagnostics at Frederick Hospital and Dynacare Laboratories. He tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke that the prevalence of sepsis is nothing new, but there are some developments in the fight against it that will make the subject especially relevant today.
Sepsis is an age-old problem, and we continue to encounter its deadly effects. Mortality with sepsis exceeds, in many cases, 50% because of just the severe effects that happen. One of the reasons why we're continuing to see, you know, an increased emphasis placed on sepsis today is, number one, the mortality. Number two, we've seen an explosion in clinical diagnostic tools that are available that can really improve our turnaround time. And probably most importantly, we're starting to really realize just how valuable those antibiotics that we have are. We're not developing antibiotics at a rapid pace any longer. In fact, in many cases, we're losing the war against our multi-drug resistant isolates. So we're placing a lot more emphasis on how do we conserve those antibiotics? How do we use them wisely? And when we don't need them, how fast can we take them off?
Well, let's take a step back. We think of sepsis as patients in kind of monolithic terms, like chicken pox or something. But is one case of sepsis like another case of sepsis, or are causes and treatments different?
No, causes and treatments are very, very different, and sepsis itself is very, very different. So frequently we can see, just as an example, in patients that are receiving a lot of health care, they may have some kind of a device through their skin. We'll see sepsis associated with that device. Not uncommonly. Now, it isn't that sepsis isn't severe and that we're not worried about it, but it's something we're more familiar with and we know how to manage better.
This is something like an insulin pump or—
Like an insulin pump or, you know, in a patient that's receiving a bone marrow transplant, a catheter that may be going through or a line that may be going through their skin. Even somebody with a non-native heart valve. So they've had a valve replacement and that valve is then very susceptible to colonization with bacteria and subsequent development of sepsis. Those are all very common things and we encountered them, but the sepsis associated with them may or may not be less severe. But even if we think about a normal patient that doesn't encounter their healthcare provider aside from their annual physical, they're still at risk for sepsis. And the type of sepsis and the severity varies greatly. A patient may end up having sepsis that is not acute. You may be septic actually on a daily basis when you brush your teeth. It's brief. Your immune system normally takes care of it, but we don't go to the hospital every day after we brush our teeth. It's really those patients that develop severe sepsis that we're most concerned about.
Well, and let's take a step even further back. Sepsis, the full name is septicemia, right? And it essentially means an infection of the blood?
Correct.
It typically starts with an outside body getting into an outside bacteria getting into us?
Well, actually, quite interestingly, urinary tract infections, if we look at it worldwide and even nationwide across the U.S., urinary tract infections are the leading source of sepsis. If we trace back that cause of sepsis to the body site that may have caused that infection, urinary tract infections and respiratory tract infections are the one and two leading causes of sepsis.
Okay, so now that everybody who is listening to this is paranoid about every potential health condition that they've had, let's talk about why it has been so hard to pin down historically. As you say, some cases of sepsis are relatively minor. Why do some become relatively major and in fact, fatal?
Well, and that's a great question, and that's an area of intense research that's currently being focused on. Why are some patients at higher risk for sepsis versus others? Again, a patient that's undergoing complex medical evaluations, for example, again, a bone marrow transplant or another organ transplant, in order to transplant them, we have to suppress their immune system. It puts them at significantly higher risk. But other patients that, develop a urinary tract infection and then end up developing sepsis, why some go on to sepsis and others don't is really an area that we don't understand yet and is still very acutely being researched.
Things are changing also in terms of the way that you are actually able to track it down. Is that right? There's new testing technology available.
So there's a lot of new testing technology that's available. If we look back even 5 years, the methods for diagnosing sepsis haven't changed a great deal over the last 50 years. We still draw a sample of the patient's blood. We culture it. And then once that organism grows in a culture, it still takes us up to 4 days before we can tell the physician what the organism is and how best to treat that patient. And the real problem with that is if we look at patient outcome data, up to 45% of patients that have sepsis may be treated inappropriately with that first choice of antibiotics. It really highlights the importance of why treating a patient early and providing a physician with as much information as we can, as early as we can, significantly improves the patient's chance at getting put onto an appropriate antibiotic therapy.
Well, so if not much has changed in terms of the testing in the 50 years leading up to now, what's changing now?
Well, that's actually very interesting. We've seen an explosion in new technologies that are really based upon two different areas. They're based upon bacterial genetics or the bacteria's DNA, and we use that DNA as a marker to detect the bacteria and also to look for what antibiotics we can use in that patient. And that's really been one major advance. The other major advance that we're seeing is in the area of mass spectrometry or detecting bacterial proteins.
Well, and so you say there are new testing procedures that are available. Tell us more about how those play out and how they're different than what's been in place for half a century.
Sure. So one of the areas that we've been very interested through our research program is how do we improve that time to diagnosis? So what we did was we picked the most common causes of sepsis, and we designed a panel to look for those bacterial genes and look for antibiotic resistance in those samples. We then took those targets, spotted them to a single test so that we could run them all at the same time. So from a patient's perspective, once their blood culture signals positive, we can run this genetic test. Once we perform the test or once we start the test, it takes about 2 hours to perform. And from the time that the test is initiated, after the two-hour incubation, we can then report out the identification of the organism and provide the clinician with a great degree of resistance guidance in terms of this would be an antibiotic of choice, this would be an antibiotic that you may want to steer away from. Now, at Frederick, we've taken this even a little bit farther in that when we call a positive blood culture to the physician, we also notify a pharmacist. The real advantage of that is when we notify the pharmacist, they can contact the physician with a recommended antibiotic that would be optimal for that infection, allowing us to start that antibiotic faster. We've been running this test now for about a year, a little over a year. We've run in excess of about 400 patients through the test. And what we find is that when we use this test, we're providing the clinician with the identification and the susceptibility of the organism about 45 hours faster. What that means is our patients are getting placed onto an appropriate antibiotic up to 50 hours faster. Now, interestingly, the University of Michigan has done a follow-up study to this, and they found that when you use a rapid blood culture identification system, as I've described, they can actually reduce all-cause 30-day mortality by using this rapid test. So what that data suggests is that independent of everything else with sepsis, reporting the identification of the infecting organism and as much susceptibility information as we can is an independent projection of whether that patient is more or less likely to survive their sepsis infection. So what we found is that this is incredibly important in terms of how we manage these patients and can yield significant positive impacts.
It sounds like it. Are there any downsides, any risks?
I think the only downside really of the technology to date is it's still very early in its developmental processes. I think what we'll find as we move forward that we need to continue to expand these panels even farther because we're getting about 95% of the organisms today. If we can expand them farther to get 98, 99, and even up to 100%, really that's where we want to go. And I think as technology continues to expand to build upon itself, we will get there. And really the ultimate goal is let's avoid that culture altogether because we still are delaying diagnosis. But the biggest challenge then is if we go directly from a patient specimen, how do we get our sensitivity or our limit of detection of our test high enough so that we are accurately predicting the risks that this patient has?
Well, and so you mentioned, you know, the in some cases sepsis has a 50% or greater mortality rate. Is the difference in the amount of time likely that you're able to diagnose and potentially start treatment, is that likely to be a game changer?
It is likely to be a game changer. So a study that was done back in 2006 looked at outcomes of patients with sepsis, and it particularly looked at when their blood pressure drops. From the moment that their blood pressure drops, every hour that we delay effective antimicrobial therapy, mortality increases by 7%. So the earlier that we can provide this result, the better we are likely to have in terms of an outcome for the patient.
How is the changes in terms of the fact that there are more and more bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics? Are there enough weapons out there that, regardless of what you're able to find in terms of the cause of the sepsis, are there weapons out there to treat it?
By and large, we're still able to treat a majority of infections. In Milwaukee especially, we're very, very lucky because our resistance rates are actually quite low compared to the rest of the United States. And even if we go as far south as Chicago, their resistance rates are considerably higher.
Why is that?
It's really a question that we don't know the answer to. Why? Because, populations of Milwaukee and Chicago are very fluid. I mean, take me for example. I go to Chicago once, twice a month or more. And we even see an exchange among hospitalized patients. So it's not, again, not really an area that's well understood. Maybe it's the cheese curtain between us and Illinois.
What do you think the takeaway for the average person ought to be? Should this be the kind of thing in the back of our mind when we're feeling really sick, or is this really a wake-up call for the medical profession?
I think it's truly a wake-up call for the medical profession. It's an area internationally that we've decided as a medical profession we need to do a better job. There is a group, an international group that was put together called the Surviving Sepsis Campaign, and they've come up with a number of different recommendations for how we can better manage patients with sepsis. And it ranges from how do we feed our patients or how do we give them nutrition to how do we diagnose them and how do we treat those patients. And that's really where the project that we've been working on is very focused in terms of how do we diagnose them and how do we release information in a whole lot less time.
Well, and so in terms of in that dynamic, there are better ways to diagnose, presumably better ways to treat. Are there better ways now to keep it from happening in the first place?
In terms of better ways to treat, to knowing or to preventing it from happening, again, because we don't know in up to 25% of cases, we don't know what caused that case of sepsis. So to a certain understanding, we really don't know why sepsis happens in some patients and others. So preventing it is a bit more difficult. I think the true key is, you know, make sure that, you know, you stay in good health all the time and that's really about all you can do.
And you would keep brushing your teeth even with that risk.
I absolutely will keep brushing my teeth even with that risk.
Nate Lederbor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Nate Lederbor is Medical Director for Microbiology and Molecular Diagnostics at Froedtert Hospital and DynaCare Laboratories. He's also an assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Lederbor spoke with Mitch Teich, and you can find a link to the study on the effectiveness of new tests for sepsis from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, sepsis played a role in baseball history. We'll learn about that and some other unheralded baseball history when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Before the break, we heard about developments in the effort to detect and treat the blood bacterial infection known as sepsis. You might not think that there would be a natural connection between an interview about sepsis and one about baseball history, but sports writer Steve Rushen has uncovered a little-known but very real link. He'll tell us more about that in just a few minutes. Rushen, who is a columnist for Sports Illustrated and a Marquette graduate, is the author of the book The 34-Ton Bat, The Story of Baseball as Told Through Bobbleheads, Crackerjacks, Jockstraps, Eye Black, and 375 Other Strange and Unforgettable Objects. Speaking by phone from Connecticut, Rushen tells Lake Effect's Mitch Teich that the journey for him started with one unforgettable object that belonged to his grandfather.
Well, my grandfather was a guy named Jimmy Boyle who played, I always say, one season for the New York Giants in 1926, but he really played only one game and then ended up getting into only one inning of one game for the Giants as a catcher. And I found out that my uncle in Reno, his son, had his catcher's mitt still. And he shipped it to me by UPS, and I opened this box. My grandfather died 8 years before I was born, so I never got to meet him. But when I took out this 1920s catcher's mitt out of the box and the styrofoam peanuts fell out, I put it onto my left hand, and it was perfectly formed to my grandfather's hand. And it was like shaking hands for the first time with a grandfather I never got to meet. And, you know, I did what most people would do, most men any way I think would do, which was I placed it over my nose and mouth and inhaled like it was an airline oxygen mask. And I really felt like I could smell the Polo Grounds in June of 1926 on a Sunday afternoon against the Pirates. You know, that kind of led me off into wanting to know what his life was like, but also the lives of baseball players from another era. You know, I set off on exploring baseball and history and also the history of the culture at large through the objects of baseball, not just mitts and hats and bats and balls, but things like beer bottles and bobbleheads and protective cups. And a year and a half later, I came up for air and had this book.
Well, walk us through how you explored this from the present, aside from being able to inhale your grandfather's mitt and imagine being in the polo grounds that many years ago. These stories aren't necessarily a secret, but I don't know that there's been a lot written about, say, stirrup socks and sanitary hose in the past. How were you able to make the connections to things that maybe existed for a long time afterward, but go all the way back to what was then known as, say, blood poisoning?
Well, part of it is, how did this come to be? What is the point of this apparently completely pointless decorative sock, the stirrup, that baseball players wore for 80 or 90 years, and has started to come back into fashion as a retro thing for some players? And just working backwards and trying to find what was the first appearance of this word in the story, or how did this come to be? And it turns out that baseball players and people in general had a great fear of blood poisoning in the early 1900s. Knapp Lajoie, the great Cleveland hitter, was out, spiked, and out for the rest of the season in 1905 and was convalescing. There's a picture in the book of him on his porch with his leg up. And when these players came down with what was diagnosed as blood poisoning, there came to be an assumption that when they were being spiked in their colorful socks, and obviously baseball teams have been known by the colors of their socks for a century and a half, that the color, before color fast dyes existed, was bleeding into the open wound and poisoning their blood. It wasn't the case, but that's what they thought at the time. And so somebody, I still don't know who, decided to cut a half moon in either side of the sock, leaving just a little stirrup at the bottom to hold the sock on in the shoe, and then put an undyed white, quote, sanitary sock under that stirrup. So in case they got spiked there, the colors wouldn't bleed through. Now imagine you're stuffing a second sock inside the first sock and stuffing all of that into a hot leather shoe in the days when players wore the heaviest flannel 8 ounces to the yard that anybody could manufacture, and would go out there on 9,500 degree days in St. Louis, say, and heat prostration was also not uncommon. It wasn't uncommon to see players just drop on a baseball field. And these were the kinds of things that you don't often see in old black and white film or see on the back of a baseball card, but you realize when you start to do some research that this was what life actually was when you're riding trains and playing in hot flannel and getting spiked in 1905.
Right, right. You described a scene where one of the teams is riding the trains and they essentially disrobe and have their clothes airing out in their car as the train would go from one city to the next.
Right, and these windows had screens on them, and so the ash from the smokestack wasn't blowing into the train windows. And from Boston to St. Louis, say, if you were going from the Boston Braves to the St. Louis Cardinals, that was an 18-hour train trip, which is about the distance, you know, you could fly to Australia nearly that time now. But, you know, that was, people talk about the romance of the trains, and it wasn't romantic. It was only romantic to those people who are looking back at it from our perspective.
It's tempting to just have you roll through some of these stories, but maybe we can focus on a couple more specific areas, one with a good local connection for us here. The man most responsible for the idea of baseball souvenirs actually got his start in Milwaukee.
Yeah, a guy named Danny Goodman, who, was somebody I hadn't known at all prior to starting the book, was from Milwaukee. He went from Milwaukee to Baltimore in minor league baseball. He started out with the Harry Stevens Company and went to Baltimore, sold concessions there. From Baltimore, went to the Yankees' top minor league affiliate in Newark and came up with all of these innovations, including, you know, why should a guy come to a game in a suit, as people did then, and sit down on a wet bleacher seat after a rain? We should sell these guys or rent them seat cushions. You know, what about an umbrella? What about having a fully stocked bar in the back of the bleachers where a guy can come and get a drink during the game or before the game? And all of these things that he came up with, many of them were met with resistance, but some of them were not, including, why don't we sell T-shirts with the team name on it, the Newark Bears, to people? See if they would be interested in buying those. Why don't we sell hats to people? And he became so successful at doing this that Bob Cobb, the owner of the Brown Derby restaurant in Hollywood, guy who invented the Cobb salad, hired him to come west to work for the Hollywood Stars, his baseball team in the Pacific Coast League, which was then almost a quasi-major league team. This is in the early 1940s. Danny Goodman went out there to Hollywood, where he could really sort of let his light shine, and had all manner of promotions, giveaways, and Hollywood Stars of the day came out to the game, not only came out to the games, but many were be became part owners, Lucy and Desi and Jimmy Stewart and Humphrey Bogart. And long story short, by the time the Dodgers moved west from Brooklyn, the first guy that Walter O'Malley hired when the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles was Danny Goodman. And the Dodgers, forever after, to this day, are the team with the most promotions. Every Dodger homestand was Bat Day or Helmet Day or Jacket Day, some kind of giveaway. And Danny Goodman is largely responsible for that. He's the guy who envisioned in the late 1950s, early 1960s, that fans will one day come to a ballpark and it will almost be a retail store with a ballpark attached. And if you've been to any of the new stadiums, you know that that's exactly what has come to pass.
It was as though he and California were tailor-made for each other.
Exactly. And the Hollywood Stars Stadium ballpark was across from where CBS built CBS Television City. So all of these CBS television stars and Hollywood stars in general who had to pass through CBS studios there would often lure them over across the street to a game. And when the Dodgers finally moved into Dodger Stadium, he would do the very same thing. And everybody who came to a game, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, all left with one of those satin Dodger baseball jackets. And if you can see images of all of these guys in those Dodger jackets. And through that means, those Dodger jackets traveled around the world, and so did the name of the Dodgers. And it made the Dodgers a marketing force.
This is a horrible transition, but the idea of tailor-made reminds me that another unsung hero of baseball, who was foul-proof Taylor?
Well, you say he is unsung, but he also did a lot of singing because he's a guy who sort of made his living asking people to punch him or kick him in the crotch. And he's a guy who was an immigrant from England. This is around 1909. And eventually worked in a telegraph office in New York and became a kind of an extra in the chorus of the Metropolitan Opera. In the 1920s, he was performing in the background of the Metropolitan Opera when, coming off stage during Act One of Turandot, he was speared by a spear carrier in the groin. Immediately after the show, he went out and bought a supply of rubber cigars and a sheet of aluminum, and he fashioned a protective cup. Went back the next night, asked the guy to spear him. He was fine. And he started taking this invention. He thought he was the first to come up with it, around to New York City boxing gyms and asking the heavyweight champions and contenders of the day to, quote, hit me here. And most of them happily obliged. And he had a real innovative and useful device, not only for its obvious protective qualities, but because at the time in boxing, there was a real problem that if a fight could end on a low blow, if somebody was hit by a low blow, all bets on that fight were canceled. So if a mobster was at ringside and wanted his guy was going the wrong way, he'd just tell him to hit the guy below the belt. All the bets were wiped out. And it came to a head in 1930 in a Jack Sharkey, Max Schmeling heavyweight fight. That was the first heavyweight bout ever lost on a foul when Schmeling was hit in the groin by Sharkey. And so the New York State Boxing Commission had to do something. Foul-proof Taylor always contends that the commissioner of the New York State Boxing Commission favored this other guy, Jacob Gollum, who had invented his own kind of cup. Jacob Gollum marketed that and all of his other boxing products under the brand named Everlast. So Foul-proof never got the recognition he wanted. But he went around baseball clubhouses, the reason it's in the book, trying to sell that and also trying to sell a batting helmet. He kind of changed his focus to protecting batters' noggins, and he went into the Brooklyn Dodgers clubhouse, for instance, late 1930s, and asked players to whack him over the head with a baseball bat. And many of them also obliged. And he also never made the fortune that others made off of batting helmets, which didn't become mandated until 1970. But he was a super colorful character who drank Guinness throughout the day, was the world sack racing champion at one time in his life, and died childless in Brooklyn. And when I talked to his great-niece about did he have any children, she said, no, of course, we assumed his being kicked there 30,000 times had something to do with him not having had children.
And there's another interesting point from a protective gear standpoint. You write about the Major League Baseball logo, which is this, you know, really iconic image. But at the time it was unveiled, it was a little revolutionary because the batter that is pictured is clearly wearing a batting helmet before they were necessarily the norm.
Right. Though a year after they unveiled that logo, batting helmets would be mandated by Major League Baseball. But as with hockey, the players who were already playing were grandfathered in. They weren't required to wear them. And as late as 1979, until he retired, Bob Montgomery, the backup catcher for the Red Sox, didn't wear a batting helmet, even though his manager at the time, Don Zimmer, had been beamed so severely that he very nearly lost his life in the 1950s. But
it's amazing to think of that. 1979, there's still a guy that was going in with just a protective lining in his hat.
It's unbelievable. And the reason that protective lining existed in the first place was, even after Ray Chapman of the Indians was killed by a thrown ball, a pitched ball in 1920, players refused to even entertain the notion of wearing helmets because it would make them look chicken in their primitive minds. That was what people thought at the time. It will make me look like a wuss. I won't look like a man. In the early 1940s, the Dodgers developed the liners with this guy, Dr. Walter Dandy, a Johns Hopkins brain surgeon. And the genius of the protective plastic liners is that they zipped into the inside of the player's hat, so nobody knew they were wearing them. That's why people immediately adopted cups. They were put in your pants. Nobody could see you're wearing them. But obviously, if cups were worn on the outside, nobody would wear them. Same thing happened with gloves in the late 1880s. Nobody wore them until Albert Spaulding, a big star, started wearing them. I mean, just like leather driving gloves to catch the baseball. And once he did, oh, gee, I guess he's a big star. He can do it. I'll do the same thing. And, of course, Spaulding made a fortune off of selling gloves and other sporting goods. But every innovation in baseball, every protective innovation, nobody would wear until stars wore them, and then everybody did. Batting gloves were the same thing. And now, of course, guys go to the plate in medieval armor. There's no stigma attached whatsoever anymore to going up there with as much protective equipment as possible. But that wasn't the story for the first 120 years of baseball.
When you set out to write this book, did you feel like you had to guard against over-romanticizing an earlier era of baseball?
A little bit. And part of it was to, you know, that era has been so romanticized that we have lost sight of what it was really like for these guys. On the other hand, I do have a huge affection for, the baseball that I grew up with. I think everybody, you know, has a nostalgia for whatever their era of falling in love with something was. For me, it was baseball in the 1970s, which doesn't usually inspire a lot of affection, the polyester uniforms and all that. So part of the answer is yes. I think a lesson learned from the book is that anything that the players have done today, players either were or would have done 150 years ago. Would they have taken steroids? Absolutely. Would, you know, mostly they were taking performance-degrading drugs in the late 1880s and early 1900s. Alcohol was a huge problem. Pete Browning, the story is in the book, literally fell asleep off leading off second base and was picked off and, you know, had a huge drinking problem. Owners were as crassly money-grabbing then as they are now. Players the same way. You know, I recognize that it wasn't any different than it is today. Human nature hasn't changed, but I do still have a huge affection for ballpark organists and a lot of the kind of disappearing culture that we've lost. Having said that, only white people could play baseball. There were so many, you know, there was the reserve clause that bound a player economically to his team at the club owner's whim. So to think that baseball was somehow better then is nuts. It's infinitely better now. But it was very interesting the way the game developed.
You thank a lot of baseball people from the Hall of Fame and from really around the world of sports in your acknowledgments. But there's an especially evocative line where you thank your mom as well.
It was Pete Rose against the Mets in 73 in the playoffs, winning a game at Shea Stadium with a home run. My mom, who grew up in Cincinnati, her father was the one who played for the Giants for one game in 1926, and even though I grew up in Minneapolis, outside of Minneapolis, my mom never sort of left Cincinnati, and Cincinnati is where professional baseball started in 1869 with the very first fully professional team, the Cincinnati Red Stockings. You know, she grew up in western Cincinnati, the west part of Cincinnati where Pete Rose was from. My grandfather's brother, Buzz Boyle, played for the Brooklyn Dodgers, but then later became a scout who was instrumental in signing Pete Rose to the Reds. And that sort of all culminated with, you know, my mom dancing in the living room when Pete Rose hit a home run in the late afternoon shadows at Shea Stadium. I had just gotten off the bus, got home in time to watch from school, got home in time to watch the end of the game on TV when World Series games or playoff games were still shown in the afternoon. My mom died in 1991, just a few weeks before the Twins won the World Series in Minneapolis there. And, you know, it's one of the enduring images I always have of my mom. She wasn't a huge sports fan, but the Cincinnati Reds she was crazy for, and so much of that had to do with just what I'm describing here, her nostalgia for childhood, the place she grew up, and the culture that she grew up in. And, you know, part of that, I think, was missing her father, and seeing the Reds winning brought all that back to her.
we probably attach too many metaphors to baseball already, sure. but you can almost think of baseball in a growing up phase, and you know, remembering this era of baseball is really like remembering baseball as a child, warts and all.
Yeah, there is so much in the book about guards against this kind of nostalgia. People throwing beer bottles, empty beer bottles and soda bottles at players and umpires was a constant occurrence that eventually led to the paper cup, so it made it more difficult to physically assault somebody on the baseball field. Umpires getting pummeled at home plate for making bang-bang calls, just all kinds of insane stuff that you would never want to revisit except in reading a book. The warts are plentiful, and baseball has a real problem now in attracting television viewers. They're playing their World Series games that end at 1 o'clock in the morning on the East Coast. But, you know, it's still, for many of us, and I know plenty of kids too, 15 and under, who still love the game. There's something about it goes back to that first page of the book, smelling that leather glove that it just can't be replicated.
Well, Steve Rushen, thank you so much for helping us open that window into this era.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Steve Rushen's latest book is called The 34-Ton Bat. The story of baseball is told through bobbleheads, crackerjacks, jockstraps, eye black, and 375 other strange and unforgettable objects. Rushen, who's a graduate of Marquette University, writes a regular column for Sports Illustrated. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich from his home in Connecticut, and you can hear more of their conversation at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then essayist Mel Miskimmin looks for and finds a sign from her late mother. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The holiday season can be stressful under normal circumstances, but for anyone who's lost someone close to them, they can be particularly difficult. Essayist Mel Miskimmin lost her mother in the spring, and she's facing her first Christmas without her.
After my mom died, I waited for her to send me a sign. It was August. Mom passed in April. And so far, nothing. I knew the veil separating the world of the living from the dead was permeable from my past guilty pleasure watching psychic Sylvia Brown on the Montel Williams show. She knew exactly how the deceased was contacting the survivor. "Every time you smell a cigar, it's him," she'd say. Or simply, "feathers." Was I a believer? Not really. She gave people peace of mind and closure. What's wrong with that? I needed closure. I needed peace of mind. I needed feathers. How does one choose a psychic? The internet. Did I care about a person's ability to channel the Archangel Metatron who walked the earth as Enoch? No. The more I read about spirit realms and metaphysical soul retrievers, the thing I cared about? My immortal soul. Was I playing with hellfire? And then I saw a listing. The psychic's name, same as mine. Her suite number, 817. And when is my birthday? August 17th. I got an appointment for that Wednesday. As I waited in the hallway, I heard her checking her voicemail through the office door. "Hi, it's Sharon. I just wanted to call about my soul contracts. Call me. Bye."
It's Anthony, and I forgot what you said about my star chart.
"Hi, it's Sharon again. The dog's not eating. Is it because she's mirroring my issue with food?" I was just about to run to the elevator and press lobby when her door opened. She looked the way I had hoped, Judy Dench, with a heaping helping of Helena Bonham Carter. Her office was the great and powerful Oz meets Mad Men. The smell took me back to another lifetime, another place. Madison, 1974. She lit the regulation psychic medium candle. "How can I help you?" she said. "I want to know why my mom hasn't sent me a sign," I said. "How long has it been since she crossed?" "April," I said. She said nothing. She just looked at me, the wall. Was this the moment? "Mom?" "Your mother was confused," she said. Yeah, she was a little loopy, I said. She thought she was dreaming. Oh, was she alone? I said. There was a woman with a big hat, a deep red wine color. My mom had a black and white picture of her mother from 1922 in a big brimmed hat that she told me was a deep red wine color. That was freaky. How come I don't feel her around me? I said. She shrugged. I'm sorry, our time is up. That's it? A shrug? She couldn't have made something up like, she sends you spam email. I walked to the elevator and pushed the express button. To hell. When I got home, I called my dad to see how he was doing. I tried to call you, he said, but I kept getting this message, something about your inbox being full. It had been a while since I purged. I started to delete, delete, delete without paying attention, and then I just happened to see the date and the time. I pressed play. Hi, it's your mom. I'm doing much better today, so you don't have to worry about me. If you were going to worry, don't worry. Bye. I pressed the save button. I had my sign.
Lake Effect essayist Mel Maskimmon is a contributing writer for More Magazine, a guest blogger on The Huffington Post, and the author of Cop's Kid. She lives in Milwaukee. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned.